Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulibe. This week on Culturetopia. In the new film, Everything Must Go, comedian Will Ferrell tones down his trademark antics to play an alcoholic down on his luck. The new comedy Bridesmaids stands out among this summer's more unrealistic summer wedding movies. And a look at a dance style in music called footwork, which has livened up parties in Chicago since the 1990s. But first,
it's called the National Jukebox. We're talking about music and sound recorded at the beginning of the 20th century, 10,000 records worth, that you can now access on the internet. The effort was launched yesterday by the Library of Congress and Sony Music Entertainment. NPR's Tom Cole reports on what's being billed as the largest collection of historical recordings ever made publicly available online.
The recordings in the National Jukebox date from the first quarter of the 20th century, a time, says Patrick Lockney, chief of the Library of Congress's Packard Campus for Audiovisual Conservation, when this country's entertainment landscape was changing.
Before the advent of recordings, people had to go to vaudeville and variety theaters to see this kind of entertainment. And the recording industry captured that history before it passed from the American scene.
Lockney points to the widespread popularity of opera and the way its melodies were embraced by all kinds of musicians, like the Six Brown Brothers Saxophone Ensemble playing Rigoletto Quartet in 1916. This recording and the more than 10,000 others are available for streaming free at the library's jukebox website. The project began about 7 years ago at the University of California, Santa Barbara, which was working on its own archival effort to document all of the available information on all of the recordings made and released by the Victor Talking Machine Company between 1900 and 1950. The first half of that catalog now makes up the National Jukebox. But David Soibert, curator of the Performing Arts Collection at UCSB, says there was a problem.
The biggest frustration, though, is that you go to our website, which is just a discography, and you're like, well, I want to hear that recording.
And that's where the library came in.
The Library of Congress really, you know, was essential to this because they had the muscle to work with Sony to get a license to stream them online.
After a series of mergers, Sony Music Entertainment now controls all of the rights to the Victor recordings, says the library's Patrick Lockney.
All of these recordings are made available to the library on a license basis, a free license to make these recordings available through the library's website, but Sony Music retains all the rights to these recordings otherwise.
So Sony controls the rights to the first recording of the Paul Whiteman Orchestra's Rhapsody in Blue with composer George Gershwin at the piano. Recordings are searchable through the database created for the library by the University of California, Santa Barbara's Victor Project. And the Victor Talking Machine Company recorded just about everything for commercial release. It made money on what used to be called ethnic recordings, music and spoken word intended for a wide variety of recent immigrants, and it sold campaign speeches by presidential candidates like Theodore Roosevelt, says UCSB's David Soibert.
Pre-radio, this was pre-television. You know, Roosevelt and the candidates, they released a whole series of records that then, you know, you could get their position.
The welfare of our people is vitally and intimately concerned with the welfare of the farmer.
Getting all of this material online was not easy. Forget about the logistics of the database and digitizing the audio. Sound recordings made before 1972 are covered by a chaotic collection of state, not federal, copyright laws. Again, UCSB's David Soibert.
The digital revolution in other areas has already happened. You know, with photographs, we already have huge troves of photographs online. With books, Google Books has put millions of books online. That really hasn't happened with these early sound recordings, and that's because of copyright law. If they were in another media, they would have already been in the public domain, and we would have been able to digitize them and put them online.
And changing that will be even harder than launching the National Jukebox. It'll require an act of Congress. Tom Cole, NPR News, Washington.
The comedian Will Ferrell became famous for his loopy impersonation of George W. Bush, as well as for playing characters like Buddy the Elf. And newscaster Ron Burgundy, Stay Classy San Diego, a role model for us all.
In his latest movie, Will Ferrell plays a man who is not much of a role model. He's lost his job. His wife has left him after dumping all his belongings on the front lawn, and there he soon takes up residence. Could be another Will Ferrell goofball comedy, but the movie Everything Must Go is mostly a drama based on a short story by Raymond Carver. It's about an alcoholic man's attempt to make any sort of human connection. Here, he approaches his pretty new neighbor, played by Rebecca Hall, who's just relocated from Manhattan to this southwestern suburb.
Hey, I was going to order Chinese food. It's not New York, but...
You know, I have a lot of stuff to do before my husband gets here.
Right. No, I understand.
But thank you for the offer.
Sure. Could I use your phone to order?
It is mostly serious movie, but there are these wonderful moments in there. Will Ferrell joined us from our New York bureau to talk about Everything Must Go. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nick Halsey, your character, when we meet him on his lawn, which is practically a character. Describe that lawn.
Basically, Nick comes home, finds all of his possessions out there, is locked out, his wife has left, and instead of fleeing, he decides to set up shop and arrange all of his personal effects in a way that it becomes basically a room for him to live in, and he makes it comfortable to exist out there.
That would be for him a tiki bar, an old record player.
Right, a mini fridge, a samurai sword collection, just all these various things, and he arranges them along with, you know, dresser drawer and everything and makes a home.
And it's kind of weird because we're talking, you know,
suburban
street in, you know, Phoenix, Arizona, and neighbors do look askance at his collection.
Exactly.
And his life out there, which is where the title comes in, Everything Must Go, in we learn he's sort of allowed to do this legally because...
Yeah, we find out he's had bouts with drinking, and that's actually one of the reasons why he's let go from his job. But his AA sponsor comes and checks in on him and finds out that the police have said he has to leave his lawn unless he has a yard sale, and that will give him an extra 5 days. He can actually stay on his lawn. So he's forced to have a yard sale to live out there. And that pushes him to figure out if he's going to move on from this point or just stay settled.
You have spoken about how you found your way into other characters. Like when you played the nerdy cop in The Other Guys, you got your hair cut
at a Supercuts
in San Fernando Valley. Was there something particular you did to find your way into this darker character?
Yeah, I really actually stayed alone for the entire filming. I didn't try to go out at all with the cast at any point. I also experimented one night. I got completely drunk and had a friend just tape me on a flip phone just to see if what sort of physical transformation I went through. What I found out was I'm just a very happy drunk.
Unfortunately, because he's not. Really.
Yeah, he's not. And so it's not like I went into a depressive rage or anything. But I did feel the effects because this guy is cracking a beer as soon as he wakes up in the morning. And just that heavy feel of what that must be like to have that in your system.
Nick Halsey is not the only alcoholic in his family. It comes out that a big part of his issue is that his father was also an alcoholic. And it comes out because the two things he will not sell are a signed baseball and a box of old LPs that belong to his father, who had a bit of a glamour career as
a DJ.
Disc jockey.
Yes.
You know, your father was a professional musician who, I gather, toured with the Righteous Brothers.
Uh-huh.
Did you find anything in that you brought to this movie?
You know, I'm a child of divorced parents, and it happened 8 years old, I think I was. And that loneliness you do feel as a child, I was able to think back to that and, you know, sitting alone as a kid listening to sad Chicago songs from the car radio.
From the
band Chicago, actually. There was some song that used to come on as a kid that, if I hear it now, it'll literally put me back to my 70s childhood and wishing my parents weren't divorced.
do you remember which song?
It's the one, if you leave me now, you take away the biggest part of me. I can't sing the high part, but that's when your mom could go grocery shopping and leave you in the car. That was that era that doesn't exist anymore. But I would sit and listen to the car radio and purposely feel melancholy. So
it's been written about this movie already that possibly to enjoy it, fans of yours must be ready to see in Everything Must Go a different Will Ferrell. Is this a step in sort of the next way to be after embodying in much of your comedies a guy who just can't grow up? I mean, do you have to grow up as a performer to keep being creative?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I always find it actually funny that the analysis is that the characters I play in comedies are the man-child, the adolescent characters that refuse to grow up. And yet, if you kind of look back in the history of comedy, all the way back to the Marx Brothers, that's a big part of comedy. And no one ever criticized the Marx Brothers for, I wish they would grow up and stop banging each other on the head. You know, I think it's natural to want to evolve throughout a career, and getting to do a movie like this is not a conscious effort to put that ball in motion. It was just an opportunity to do something different and to show that, as far as I believe, that I have this ability to actually give a fairly straight dramatic performance, although there are definitely funny moments. This is probably the most real, quote unquote, thing I've ever done.
You know, some actors and comedians have the distinction of playing characters that become part of the culture. Is there a particular character in your oeuvre that you can't shake?
Well, it kind of depends on the crowd of people I'm with, the time of year. Obviously around Christmas time, there's a lot of people coming up saying, we just watched Elf, which is so crazy to me because I just remember running around in a pair of tights in New York City thinking, oh, this could be the end of my career. Either this is going to be a really big movie or people are going, why did he do that? What was he thinking?
Will Ferrell stars in the new movie Everything Must Go. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Renee. It was a pleasure.
In 2007, Christopher Hitchens wrote a column in Vanity Fair, and in that column, he argued that women are not funny. This is what he wrote. He wrote, why are women who have the whole male world at their mercy not funny? Please do not pretend not to know what I am talking about. Well, you can imagine the reaction he received from that article. Bob Mondello is in the studio with me. Bob, Christopher Hitchens wrote that in 2007, women aren't funny.
That's craziness. Oh, my God. What about Carol Burnett? What about...
She was funny.
And Lucille Ball
she
and Tina Fey. And
funny?
Oh, my God. God, no.
I am asking you this question, Bob, because there are three films out right now, Jumping the Broom, Something Borrowed, and Bridesmaids, all written by women, all starring women. They are female comedies, and they all take place against the backdrop of weddings.
Yes, they are. And two of them are what you'd call conventional women's comedies.
This Jumping the Broom and Something Borrowed.
That's right.
Conventional, and, you mean?
Well, that they feature women in the way that we're accustomed to seeing women featured in pictures. To some extent, women are put on pedestals in bridal comedies. You know, they wear the pretty dresses and
everything. So a lot of tears, hugs.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And much caring. Enormous amounts of caring. Mm.
So let's hear a clip from the film Something Borrowed. This is a scene with Kate Hudson and Jennifer Goodwin, and they're talking about their friendship.
I don't think there's anybody who knows me like you. It's like you totally accept me.
Nurse, why are you saying all this?
I don't know.
Aww,
yeah, I don't
so
either.
Yes. That's a comedy?
Well, it's part of a comedy. It's the night before the wedding, and they're having this chat. And I have to say, I imagine that people do have that kind of chats before weddings. I've actually had that kind of a chat with male friends before a wedding, but it isn't the center of things. And if you have a comedy with women in it, and one of them has stolen the other one's boyfriend, you would expect them to scream at each other, and they kind of don't through the whole movie because they have to be supportive of each other. This is how women are portrayed in pictures with other women.
So this is by the way, is it funny? Did you think it was funny?
I loathed it. I couldn't stand this movie. This drove me crazy. But that isn't why I think it's a conventional comedy. I think it's a conventional comedy because I didn't recognize those characters. I don't know people like those women.
Right.
I don't believe it.
Let me ask you about the film Something Borrowed, because the character played by Jennifer Goodwin is supposed to be kind of frumpy and and she's not. I mean, she's,
I don't know who decided that poor woman. Jennifer Goodwin is frequently cast as the frump.
She's cute.
Adorable.
Yeah.
Absolutely adorable. I have no idea who made that decision about her career, but she should play somebody willowy and gorgeous.
Is there this idea that, you know, really absolutely stunning female actors cannot do comedy because it's too distracting, or...
Oh, gee. I guess, and really stunning men can't either, right?
Right.
If you're really good looking, it's harder to do comedy, I
but
suppose.
But I mean, there aren't – I mean, George Clooney can pull it off. But I mean, some of these –
I don't know. Lucy. Right? Go back to Lucy.
Lucille Ball, right?
Lucille Ball was – before she became a comedian – was regarded as a showgirl. Mm. She was just beautiful. You always saw her in movies. She was wearing an evening gown. She was gorgeous. They had to make her look frumpy in I Love Lucy because otherwise, I guess, people wouldn't feel as comfortable laughing at her.
Okay, here is a clip from another film. It's called Bridesmaids, and the producer is Judd Apatow, famous for Superbad and The 40-Year-Old Virgin. He didn't write it. It was written by Kristen Wiig from Saturday Night Live. And here is a clip from the film. It is just a warning to people listening. It's gross.
Oh, you're playing that
We're going to play that one. Okay. Here it is.
I don't know what to say. You look lost. Megan, are you okay?
My dress was probably just tight.
Oh, my God. You got food poisoning from that restaurant, didn't you?
No, I had the same thing that she had, and I feel fine.
All right. All right, this is Bob.
I can't even imagine where that goes because they're not showing the rest of that clip.
this is a pretty gross scene, and there are a lot of these kinds of gross moments in this movie. People are talking about this as being the first, you know, female gross-out film ever made.
Yeah, well, it's not that. But it is different, though. What is different about it is that these women are human. They have the same frailties
there
that men do.
There are flatulence jokes.
Exactly.
And you
go into digestive tract in ways that you don't usually in pictures about women. But that is the big difference, that the women are allowed to behave normally. The way that this is being portrayed in the press in general is that it's women acting like men.
Ah.
And I think the difference is not that women are now acting like men, but that women are getting the same privilege that men do to act like human beings in these movies. I think that's the big difference.
So it is groundbreaking in a sense.
I think it is in a way. Although my favorite comedians, Lucy frequently acted like a real human being. I mean, you saw her in that kind of situation. The best women comics are all about being human, are all about being recognizable. But I think it is doing one thing that I think you and I, two men, are on the radio today talking about women comics.
Yep.
And I think as long as that conversation goes on, that's a game changer.
That's NPR's Bob Mondello. Bob, thanks so much for coming in.
It's always a pleasure.
A box truck used by day for delivering goods. But in New York and San Francisco, they've been given new life as creative outlets. Artists and performers have set up mobile installations and carnival-like attractions inside them. The gatherings are called Lost Horizon Night Markets. One was held recently in the Bay Area, and John Kalish sent this report.
In a desolate industrial section of West Oakland, 20 box trucks arrive before sundown. A couple of cargo trailers are parked on a street that is home to an abandoned cement factory. When this Lost Horizon night market is in full swing, a bunch of sideshows and art environments will comprise what is essentially an open party for adults in a public space. Attorney Michael Burstein is the self-described cat herder-in-chief for the San Francisco night markets.
We're probably in violation of a variety of parking ordinances. I'm sure that some of the attendants will show up and have open containers, which is illegal in San Francisco or in Oakland. And I'm sure that there will be a variety of minor infractions.
Burstein is right about the open containers. Many in the crowd of 700 swig from bottles of wine or small stainless steel flasks. Invitations to these night markets are spread by word of mouth. People are asked not to publicize them on mailing lists, blogs, or via social networking channels. People are wandering from one box truck to another parked along the dark city block. The best little box truck in West Oakland has swinging saloon doors, a bar that serves sarsaparilla, and several bales of hay to cushion the fall off a mechanical bull with a bunny head on it. The entertainment at this inner-city carnival is a bit unusual. For those who enjoy destroying breakable objects, there's the smash truck. Inside this small box truck is a woman with a cigarette clenched between her lips. She wears a welder's mask and thick suede welder's gloves as she smashes a computer and a plastic rocking horse to bits. There's a plexiglass panel protecting onlookers from debris as the woman wails away with a hammer.
It's a good time, yeah. So a little bit of aggression goes a long way.
There's something for everyone at the Lost Horizon Night Market. If you don't want to vent aggression, you can hang out at a cozy campfire inside a truck with a hole in its roof. David Martin, a mechanical engineer at Stanford and a member of an art group called the Department of Spontaneous Combustion, presides over a fire pit improvised from a wash tub.
S'mores and sausage, huh?
Well, what else do you do with a campfire? Does anybody want a sausage?
Is this meat?
This is meat. That is burnt marshmallow.
The installation artists who participate in the Lost Horizon Night Market rent their box trucks for $150 for the day and deck them out with outlandish props that transform them into vehicles of fantasy. Inside one, there's a speakeasy where Katie McGee strums a ukulele and her sidekick, Absinthia, pours a potent green fermented beverage. McGee wears a corset, fishnet stockings, and a black feather boa as she leads the crowd in a bawdy song sing-along.
He ain't too smart, but he gets things done. He's a long-tongued, double-jointed son of a gun. He's read the Kama Sutra 26 times, and he wears my panties on Tuesday nights.
It's kind of like creating a secret city within the city.
That's Mark Krawchuk, one of the co-creators of the Night Market concept, which originated in Brooklyn in 2009.
It's like coming to the small town neighborhood that we all have virtually through emails and through news groups, and this is actually a physical manifestation of it, but mobile and temporary.
At these events, the entertainment tends towards the conceptual and avant-garde. On this night, one of the box trucks is a dream library where empty bottles hold small scrolls with dreams written on them. Another, the Notional Clearinghouse, encourages visitors to dispose of their notions.
The movie you will never film, the book you will never write, the product you will never sell. Get it out of your head, into our cabinet, gone from your cranium, and away you will go, satisfied and ready to fill it up with other things.
Hi. How are you doing tonight? Welcome to Mac and Attitude. You might only come for one, but you're going to get both.
Mac and Attitude is a 10-seat diner inside a box truck, complete with U-shaped counter covered with a checkered tablecloth.
My name is Anita. Employee of the month, 4 months. We've been operating now for 47 years, family-owned business.
Of course, the Mac and Attitude diner serves only one dish, macaroni and cheese.
We got two types tonight, one for the carnivores, one for the Vegemites. You know, they're all over San Francisco.
Whether she's a Vegemite or a carnivore, Lisa Berger of San Francisco enjoys this scene.
I feel like I'm at a carnival for adults. You see everyone running around and playing and acting like they're 5 years old again.
A Lost Horizon night market is being planned for Detroit, and organizers say that these box truck parties may surface in Portland, Boston, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish.
In Chicago, footwork isn't just fancy. It's the name of a dance style and a genre of electronic music. Since the mid-90s, footwork has been livening up Chicago parties and late-night public access television. And thanks in part to YouTube, the style's influence has begun to spread across the country and to Europe. Wills Glasspiegel went to Chicago to check out the scene.
Footwork dancers can move their feet at over 300 beats per minute. That's more than 5 steps in a single second.
Just moving your body to describe a little story to the beat.
That's Morris Harper, known as DJ Spin. His tracks, like this Nina Simone remix, inspire footwork dancing in Chicago. Some of the moves look futuristic, like fight scenes in The Matrix or Blade Runner. But others are classic and can be traced back to disco, jazz, and the jitterbug. Dancers call their steps dribbles, skates, bangs, and the ghost, which is a move where hand movements mirror foot movements as if by a thread. The organizing principle behind footwork is the circle. Dancers circle up, and the space between their bodies becomes a battleground for competitive dancing. When a song shifts, and especially when a new bass line drops, a new dancer will enter the circle like a boxer enters the ring. A club called Underground Track Factory is a hotbed for footwork on Chicago's South Side. The club is actually an abandoned kindergarten where parties happen every Sunday. When I arrived, the linoleum floor was packed. The bass was loud. It smelled like sweat and weed smoke. Footworkers practiced in front of mirrored walls. A.G. Green has been dancing footwork since the mid-90s. He's what's known as a footwork CEO. He's like a sports coach for dancers in rough Chicago neighborhoods.
We're from Westside, projects, from real dangerous hoods, but I guarantee everybody in them neighborhoods respect us because we choose not to be out there gangbanging.
AG manages two different groups of teenage footworkers, Terror Squad and Leaders of the New School. They compete for crowd approval and cash prizes. Dancers at the Underground Track Factory often graduate to become DJs. This cycle from dancing to DJing is how footwork was born and how it grows. I spoke with the originator of footwork, producer R.P. Boo, under the L-Tracks in downtown Chicago.
What I did, I actually watched the dancer, and I took what I do as a dancer and imagined myself on the floor listening to certain sounds.
In the mid-90s, Boo observed a momentum shift from paired male-female dancing to solo male competitive dancing. From that new dance, he teased out a new kind of music, footwork.
It could be something frightening, something scary, something spooky. Basically, anything that would put you in battle mode, because that's what it is. It's a battle.
So-called battle tracks enhance the competitive and combative nature of dancing in Chicago.
If you got two people on the same accord, but they battling each other, that's what makes it stronger. That's what makes my tracks get better, because I feed off of them as well as they feed for me.
So as an artist, you're fueled by creativity, but you're also fueled by competition.
Yes, it's a competitive sport.
Today, footworkers take their competition to new levels. Recently, they battled crump dancers in L.A. and with the JIT dancers in Detroit. Footwork DJs are playing Brooklyn and touring Europe. This music and culture has gone global, but at home in Chicago, they're still moving at 5 steps a second. For NPR News, this is Wills Glasspiegel.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.